All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fuck nicks? How are you? What's up? It's Mark. Hello? Hi, it's Mark. Hello? Hello? Is anyone there? Hi. Can you hear me? It's Mark. Am I, hold on, maybe it's muted or something. Am I, now? Can you hear me? Hey, what's going on? Are you okay? I didn't see you either. Is the mute on? Turn your video on. Is it video? This isn't video. This is audio. That's why you can't see me. Hello? Can you hear me? How's it going, you guys? You all right? I don't know what that was. That was a short performance piece called Can You Hear Me? That I wrote this morning. I wrote it in real time. Did it feel like that? It felt pretty scripted, though, didn't it? Are you okay? I'm okay. I feel okay. I'm going to talk to Christopher Lloyd today. Now, of course, we all know him from Back to the Future and Taxi. But Christopher Lloyd has been working consistently in theater, TV, and film for 60 years. Now, I don't know. I don't prioritize Taxi. I don't prioritize Back to the Future. For some reason, I got hung up in a lot of the early stuff. Particularly, he played Tabor in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. In an unforgettable role as one of the patients at the loony house, at the mental hospital, at the loony bin, at the nut house, at the cuckoo shack, at the mental institution. And I got off on that. I got started, you know, I don't know. You know me. What are we going to talk about? That sounds good. I don't want, there's some true evil in this fucking country. There's some true racist evil. And I didn't want to sound like I did not focus enough on those horrendous racially based killings of Asian women and the horrendous targeting of Asians here in America in general. It's awful. And I had dreams, man. There's just an awful contingent within this country that's very scary. And obviously what the Asians have been going through for years since they first got here is awful, and it's more awful now. I had a dream that I was in a car, handcuffed, and there were Nazis driving it. But they weren't Nazi Nazis. They were like, they looked like hipster Nazis. I just knew they were Nazis. You know, like selvedge denim Nazis. They look like handmade belt Nazis. You know, waxed beard Nazis. Trucker cap Nazis. Kind of guys that, you know, might wear some white's boots and a handcrafted t-shirt, maybe a Filson jacket Nazis. Guys that look like they might be in a comforting semi-folk outfit Nazis. And I remember I was in the car and I was handcuffed, but sitting sideways in the back seat behind the driver. And I just noticed a guy in the passenger seat with his waxed beard and long hair was disinfecting his hands because he was going to punch me in the face. And I couldn't understand what he was doing. Was he putting alcohol in his hands? Would it hurt me more or protecting himself? I don't know what that detail was about. It was a dream. And I remember saying, like, look, I know I'm a Jew, but you don't have to do this. And he's like putting this stuff on his hands and he's kind of hitting one into the other with that smacky sound, you know, that little smacky sound. And I'm like, you don't have to do this. And he said, hey, man, I'm not going to do it. The South is going to do it. And we just kept driving. That was a dream. I don't want any emails about judging the South. That was in my dream. Then I had some other dream about some, you know, a woman that I seemed to be in a relationship with, but I had no idea who she was. And I knew she was mad at me and leaving me. But I don't, in it, I was sort of like, we're breaking up. I don't even know who you are. I don't know what that means either. And there was another dream where I kept asking this guy not to sue me. I don't know. This happened in quick succession. You know, when you wake up and pee and you come back, oh, where are we now? I guess I'm in a car with Nazis. Then you wake up and pee and you come back and like, what's happening now? This woman wants to divorce, and I have no idea who she is. Wake up and pee and come back. Why does Ned Beatty want to sue me? Why wouldn't he just not do it? I keep saying, please, you don't have to do this. And it was Ned Beatty, a younger Ned Beatty. I have some of the great character actors in my dreams. Those guys work, man. They show up everywhere, the great character actors. Ned Beatty making an appearance as the attorney whose client was suing me. And he did a great job. He did a great job with the part. Hello? Yeah, I can hear you. Hello? Hello? Christopher Lloyd's on the show today. And I'd like to announce I have a new roommate. I'm in a new relationship. His name is Sammy. Sammy Red. Also, aliases, I think, are going to be the Samster. Sam the Man. Sammy Boy. Sammy is a 6 week and change old ginger kitten. White face, white chest, kind of stripy, not really, red. Looks very panicked and very confused, but my friend Kit brought him over. He had to be removed from his mother with the other kittens in the litter for safety reasons. And he got about 4 weeks in on the nip with the bros and the sisses. Learned some tricks, seems to be cleaning himself. Kit had him on the bottle for a while. We got him eating the solid food. He started eating the solid food and the kibble. She brought him over. We got a tent. We got some blankets. Got a scratching post. Got a fake mouse. Got a fake sardine. Got a little tiger head thing. Set up the room. Got boxes in the corners. Initially, the issue was, will he poop normal? Can we get some normal kitten poop? So now I've got him on the kitten food. With a little pumpkin mixed in. Some probiotic. And he's going at it. He's coming along. Buster is... at the door. I've let him see each other a bit. Sammy doesn't seem to give a fuck. Buster is... It really strikes me. What I'm getting from Buster, what I'm projecting onto Buster, what I'm feeling like Buster would be saying if he could, is like, why... the fuck is that here? But not like, oh shit, I'm in trouble. Not like, I'm going to kill that thing. But like, why is this little fuck here? We had a good thing going, man. We finally got rid of the oldies. And it was me and you, man. Me and you. Walking down the road of life together. And now you bring in this little fucker. What am I going to do with him? I'm going to use him as a goddamn ball. I'm going to bat him around. I'm going to throw him up and down. I don't know. Buster's a mean fucker. So we'll see what happens. But the impression I got was that he's like, all right, he's not a threat to me, but he's obviously going to be a time suck for you, which means less time for me. And that's going to cause me a little anxiety. So I might have to beat up on it a little bit. I'm just saying, that's what's going to happen in the future. That's all. I'm just saying hi. I'm just letting them know what's up. And I might pee on your shit. So heads up. I went to the farmer's market with Eliza Schlesinger's husband, Noah. He's a chef. And he's got an inn over there. You know, when you're a wholesaler, you're doing the business. Get in a little early, but it was they're checking people, they're distancing, they're only letting a certain amount of people in. I hadn't been out into that farmer's market in Hollywood for years, and I got some stuff, and it was nice. I don't even know why I'm telling you this. I guess I just wanted to tell you that I went out to the farmer's market and bought vegetables and was among the people. Everyone masked, everyone buying greens. I bought some fish at the fish guy. I got some oranges at the orange lady and some avocados at the orange lady. She wasn't orange. She sold oranges and avocados. So I guess she was the orange and avocado lady. Talked to Noah about some cooking tips. And that's all. Hello? Hello? Hi. Hello? Is this on? Can you hear me? So, I got to get rid of some apps. Because now I got the Citizen app and I've got the thing that comes with the Ring, that community. So now I'm getting it from all sides. Like Citizen's app, you get the police blotter report, like man with hat and butter knife spreading cream cheese on his arm on Glen Oaks. I saw one from the Citizen's app. Old woman sitting in sun. Like there was concern, like she couldn't be trusted to enjoy the outdoors by herself, that someone ought to go over there and check on her. And then this Ring thing is even more crazy because there's a man in my yard. Police have been called. Then, you know, Ring customer number 4. Is it the same one from yesterday? Ring customer number 72. Did you call the police? Ring customer number 84. Didn't this happen to you 2 days ago? Ring customer number 72 again. Did you call the police? Ring customer number 9. What kind of man? Not to be racially explicit, but size, maybe? Ring customer number 72. Same guy from 2 days ago? Ring customer number 42. Did you call the police? And then the original complaint. Oh, it's my husband again. I've got to stop calling the police so much. I don't need the distraction, or do I? Seems like I'm entertained by it. Seems like I'm entertained by it. We're not going to do it. The South is going to do it. So look, Christopher Lloyd is in this new movie, Nobody, with Bob Odenkirk, which I watched. Bob was good. Christopher was good. It's one of those movies. I don't really see these kind of movies, but I liked it. It's about the non-assuming guy that all of a sudden is just a fucking maniac for the good. It's in theaters this Friday, March 26th, and Christopher's wife, Lisa, was there when we had this talk, and you'll hear her chime in a few times. And this is it. As I said before, we covered One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest like it was a new film. This is me talking to Christopher Lloyd. Are you afraid you can fall asleep if you go far back?
Yeah, I just take a rest.
It's a reclining mode means it's time for nap.
I'm almost there.
Yeah?
I'm alive.
No, you're very alive. Spry, on it. I watched a movie last night, running around with guns. That's good.
I haven't done anything like that before. It was just, I liked it. I had fun, yeah.
Oh, really? You'd never done what, the gunplay?
Well, I've had a little gunplay here or there, but this was hardcore kind of, you know.
Yeah.
I was into it, yeah.
I mean, when you approach something like that, I mean, is it different than another role? Because it's sort of over the top, and you sort of know that, so you can just go to town, right?
I don't know. I was intrigued by the character. He was highly skilled, slick, dangerous motherfucker.
Yeah.
Mostly because... he just had a lot of cool. He was very smart. He knew how to handle the hardware and do little strange kind of stuff
yeah.
to entrap the victims, whoever they might be. And then he retires. He's getting a little old, you know, to be carry on like that. And then his son gets in a pickle, and I come out of my retirement, and I have like the last climax. You know, just go for it.
So if this, what if this becomes a franchise? You're gonna have to do that guy again and again.
I hope so. I hope I live long enough to do it again and again. I figure I'll be here at least for one more shot if it happens.
Like, you know, that backstory though, like just the idea that you put that backstory together, was that something that, because you've been acting a long time, and you know when you approach something like that, do you create a backstory, or is that something a director brings to you?
That's what I kind of, I mean, it was suggested in the script, but it wasn't anything they gave me. I just, you know, he comes out of retirement and he loves doing his stuff again.
You started in New York, right?
Yeah.
And where'd you grow up?
I was born in Stamford, Connecticut. And my folks always had an apartment in New York, so I was constantly going back and forth. And then as soon as I got out of high school, I went to drama school in New York when I was 19, I think. And I never left. I stayed there until, 1985. And I moved to L.A.
And where'd you go to the drama school? Where'd you start acting?
Oh, the Neighborhood Playhouse School of the Theater. And they had a phenomenal Sandy Meisner.
Yeah.
He was the greatest and made a total impression on me and what I learned from him.
What kind of guy was he? Because I tried to get an impression of him because he was sort of like the American version of the method, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean, he had such poise, intelligence. He would have a three-hour acting class at the Neighborhood Playhouse in the morning, another 3 hour in the afternoon, and then his professional class 3 hours at night. And that's a lot of time to be sitting in the chair watching people get up and do their stuff. He never ever lost focus. He'd be watching somebody doing their work.
Yeah.
Analyzing it, put it, and then he'd give the precise, exact commentary on it.
Uh-huh.
He was always supportive. He didn't mess around, but he had an extraordinary sense of humor, wit, and he was very dignified. He was a handsome kind of guy.
And like, what tools did when you approach acting even now? Like, what stuff? I mean, obviously, and I've known this from talking to many actors over and over again, that a lot of it is just, how you kind of cobble together your own system and you do what you do. But were there things that you learned from Meisner that you still are conscious of doing?
Yes, I am. I mean, I don't think about it so much now. Back then, I'd do being a player, whatever. One night, I couldn't go wrong. It's like I was in a groove and whatever. Next night, it's like I'm wallowing around the stage, trying to get into it again. And Meisner taught me how to keep focus and how to get back in the groove and all that, a technique for that, which was based, a lot of people a little perplexed. It was a word, a repeating word.
Oh, really?
To somebody else, I'd say, "Who are you?" And they'd say, "Who are you?" And it changes the behavior as you go along.
Yeah.
May not get like a yelling match, but what you he always say, what you do depends on what the other does. So you're always connected and attached, and it pulls the emotions along eventually as well when you get the sense of it.
And I mean, it's probably more consistent doing that in theater. I imagine once you make the jump to film, it's harder to hold on to that focus because, you're shooting everything in pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're still, while the camera's rolling, you could use it. You could use it in any context, really.
Yeah. Just listen and stay present.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you did how much? You did a lot of stage work initially, right?
Yes, yeah.
Do you miss that?
I do, but I still go back and do some. It's not like I got into movies and no more theater. I keep it up. There's always another play comes up. And yeah, I'm going to do King Lear this summer.
Really? Where are you doing that?
At the Berkshire Shakespeare Company.
Have you spent time in Massachusetts? Did you spend time there when you were a kid?
Yes. I went to boarding school from the third to the eighth grade in West Newton, Massachusetts.
In West Newton, Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yeah. You're familiar with Massachusetts?
Sure. I started my comedy career in the small towns and villages of New England. And I lived in Massachusetts for several years. I lived in Boston, Somerville. I lived in Brookline, just shy of Newton. But I know Newton, Route 9. and I did a lot of gigs down the Cape. There used to be a gig down in Yarmouth. at a Chinese restaurant. I was all over New England.
Uh-huh.
So what was your first play?
Well, my first paying job in New York, because I did off Broadway all over the place. I was going from one workshop to another, but at the same time, jobbing out to summer stock and regional theater and all that. But the first play I did in New York, as I remember, was the Chelsea Theater Company. I think it was Robert Kaufman was director.
Uh-huh.
And it was Casper.
Uh-huh.
By some Peter Hanke, I think, an Australian playwright. And I got an Obie for it, and it just kind of threw the doors open.
That was it? That's where it started? That's interesting. So at the beginning, you were probably doing – what years were this, in the 60s, mid-60s?
I got that play in around 1972 or 3.
So when you were doing the off Broadway stuff, you were running around doing summer stock, but were you doing all kinds of weird kind of progressive – theater shows down in the Village and stuff, and then going and doing like Noel Coward in New Jersey?
Sketchy situations.
Yeah.
I remember because and everybody worked. I was fortunate that I didn't have to have a job to get through the day. But most actors who are struggling, they'd be working during the day, and these workshops don't pay anything.
Right.
So sometimes rehearsals would start at 12 or 1 a.m. because that's the only time everybody was available.
Right.
So there was a lot of that.
Got pretty weird.
Basements.
Do you remember any strange sort of like experimental productions that you did?
Well, sort of. I did a play called Hypatia 3.
Yeah.
It was kind of a Romanesque thing with togas and shit.
Yeah.
Made no sense whatsoever. There was always more actors on stage than seated in the audience.
Yeah.
And I was about to divorce my wife at the time.
The first one?
My next wife was in the cast.
Okay.
Well, it was a change of everything.
Changing of the wives? The ceremony of the changing of the wives?
Yes, yeah. Not Lisa. Lisa came along later.
But so it was just a weird show, huh?
Yeah, but it was kind of typical.
Right. So you didn't have to work because you come from a family?
Yeah, I have a family. You know, they were kind of well off, so.
Don't you, like I read somewhere that, what is it, that you can trace your relatives all the way back to the Mayflower?
I'm told that. I have never sat down and done my homework to see if it's really true.
Right.
I think it was the second Mayflower. I don't know, but back in the day.
But your mom was from, I guess her family was part of the founding people of Texaco, huh?
Yeah. My grandpa.
Did you know him?
No, he died. I think he died the year I was born.
Was he like a wildcatter? Was he out there with the drills or was he?
I don't think so too much.
Yeah.
He went to school somewhere in Eastern Pennsylvania, a college out there. And he met a guy who was already, because Pennsylvania was one of the first places to get going with oil.
Yeah.
Another guy from Texas, and the three of them collaborated.
There you go, Texaco.
Yeah.
and you didn't have to work.
So interesting, because I kind of have an inside awareness and knowledge of the beginning of the whole oil thing.
Uh-huh.
And now it's fading out. You know, it's going, which is not a bad idea. But now it's so that was like an interesting phenomenon that came and now it's going.
Thank God. Yeah, I mean, maybe, I hope in a nick of time. Yeah, it might be too late.
Yes, I know.
We'll see. When did Cuckoo's Nest happen? How did that happen?
That happened in 1973. Yeah, I think it was 1973. I don't know, I wanted to do film, but I didn't, when I walked in an office for and meet people with a film. I just felt, you know, because I wasn't, you know, extra, you know, what do you call it?
Yeah, extroverted.
And I'm not.
You're not a song and dance man. You're a tall. You're a tall, intense gentleman.
Yeah, you know, all I got was, thank you for coming.
Weirdo, get out.
So I figured I was. It was getting to the point because I'd be set up, nothing happening, not even a nibble, and I figured that, you know, some actors don't make the bridge from theater to film.
Okay. Yeah.
And then I was doing a production of Macbeth at the downstairs theater at Lincoln Center. Vivian Beaumont, there's a theater down below, and with Christopher Walken was Macbeth.
Oh, wow.
And a few other characters.
Uh-huh.
And John Simon referred to it as that swinish production of Macbeth.
Was Walken, did he have the same intensity then?
Yes, he did. And, back then I was just getting to know him. And he was very, that you know Christopher Walken, you know?
Yeah.
But this is fucking Shakespeare, you know? I never said anything like that. And we've worked together since, and I love him. I mean, he's an extraordinary character, person.
So you're doing that? You're doing that show?
I'm doing that, and I was kind of in a crazy mood, and they sent me up. Cuckoo's Nest came to New York to cast, and they, this guy had been setting me up, sent me up to meet them. And I went up and auditioned. The auditions consisted of Milos Forman sitting the way Nurse Ratched would sit.
In a circle?
At a meeting.
Yeah.
And the myself and the other actors coming up to audition, we'd sit like that. And Milos Forman would sit in the middle and get conversation going, getting us going, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's how he decided whether or not you were going to do it. So then I got a letter. Okay, I'm going to do it. So that was.
So that's wild. So Milos would have you, you'd sit in the semicircle or the circle, and then what, he'd rotate guys in and out during an improvised audition?
Yeah, he may have, but he just feed you and get things going between us.
And do you remember, like, it was DeVito in your audition?
No.
And did you have that character of Tabor right from the get-go? Did you make decisions around how that guy would be?
Well, I did whatever I did in the audition. And then when they said, you got it, I went and got Ken Kesey's novel and studied it.
Had they done the stage play in New York already?
Yeah, Danny DeVito was in the off-Broadway production at the time.
Oh, he was. I know that originally it was, you know, Mike Douglas was trying to put it together as a vehicle for Kirk.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it was Kirk Douglas. I don't know if he was Broadway or off-Broadway, but I know that Kirk Douglas did McMurphy. And I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, I know. I think he did it on Broadway.
Yeah.
I'm not sure of that. And nothing came of it, so he gave it to his son.
His son produced it, right? Yeah. Where'd you guys shoot that? Was that shot in in a coastal town? Was it shot in Seattle or somewhere?
Salem, Oregon.
Right.
Salem, Oregon had this complex of buildings that included a prison, prison, and for the, you know, people who were a little
mentally ill.
Yeah. And they had the third floor. When pharmaceutical drugs came in, they could leave the hospital and take care of themselves with various kind of drugs.
As zombies, they could go out into the world
zombies.
and sleepwalk.
We took over an entire floor, which had a game room and the bath and sleeping quarters, all the stuff needed for the film.
Did he make you sleep there? How deep did you guys get?
We did sleep there sometimes because each of us had an assigned bed with a little table with a drawer to put your personal effects in or on. And then at night they closed it up. So you were in a cage, locked.
Oh my God.
And sometimes we did sleep there, but voluntarily we weren't being punished.
So the groupie, because it was quite a group, you know, the different all the guys it seemed that were in that crew with you either went on to, you know, major acting roles or at least character acting roles. I mean, Brad Dourif has been around forever. Even right. Like Sidney Lassick was great.
Oh, he's fabulous in it. Yeah. I remember Bill Foreman would have him do a close up on Sidney Lassick, and he'd finish his lines. And Milos would just let the camera run because he knows he's going to get gold.
Well, you too. I mean, that moment where, you know, there's a, like, I can't imagine the process of shooting that. Okay, he must have shot a lot of silence with you guys, because there's those scenes where you're just sitting there and, like, you know, that moment where you don't realize that your foot's on fire is like, I mean, it's imprinted in my unconscious. I mean, like that moment where you're like, and you just lose your fucking mind.
Right, I mean, right. Milos, he defected from Czechoslovakia. Uh-huh. He already established a film career. But he told the story of being in the subway somewhere in Czechoslovakia late at night. There were just two or three people waiting for the train. And there was a guy smoking, and he just kind of did that flick the cigarette butt, and it landed in a person's cuff. And Milos saw this, and eventually it kind of caught fire, and the guy went berserk. So he wanted to, he just figured that belongs here.
Well, I'm glad he let the guy burn in order to get that idea.
Yeah, that's.
He didn't step in. He let the scene play out.
Yeah, being the creative person he was.
I've talked to Danny DeVito, but it's so interesting to see DeVito in that part, because DeVito's such a sort of like cantankerous, brash little man, and as Martini, he's the opposite. He's like this weird kind of almost, you know, no boundaried amoeba like vulnerability of that guy.
Yeah.
You guys were doing some real acting there. And I think it was really, you know, and it seemed like, you know, certainly the Meisner stuff and that type of training was probably great for that particular movie, you know, because there was a naturalness to it that he was going for. And even Nicholson, who I think was also, I don't know where he trained, but he was definitely an American, like, you know, a methody kind of guy, that there was a naturalness to that. To all of you guys, it was kind of amazing.
Well, Milos insisted on that. I mean, if you did something too big or wasn't natural, you know, like kind of art, no.
And did you enjoy working with Jack?
Oh, I loved it. He was an idol of mine before Cuckoo's Nest.
From what?
Detail and Five Easy Pieces, et cetera. The writer. Yeah. You know, I just thought he was the cat's ass, you know, the best thing going. I remember the first day I walked on the set, and he was there talking to whatever. I'm here with this guy, you know what I mean? And he was wonderful. He was just great. And he, you know, because most of us, had scant experience in film, and he'd help you out, do this, you know. He was just so generous.
Oh yeah,
I had a scene, the bath scene where Nicholson sprays everybody.
Yeah,
and I have I'm with William Redfield, bless him, playing a game, and I'm going play the game, all that.
Oh yeah,
that scene, and Redfield was diagnosed with leukemia, and so went to a hospital and everything. So that scene never got completed at that moment.
Oh, really?
And there was, I remember Saul Zantz, who I really really loved as a producer. They were thinking, what are we going to do? Pull the plug? Or what are we going to do? So they changed the schedule around.
Uh-huh.
And in about 3 weeks, William Redford came back, or maybe less than that, but he came back. And so we got into the scene again. And I could not find it. I couldn't find my mojo, so to speak. I was like feeling awkward. And I'm trying not to show it, you know.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really. But Nicholson, during a thing, just kind of walked up to me very casually and just sort of quietly told me something I wish I could. And it put me right there, put me right where I needed to be. Just soft and quiet.
Got right in your head.
He was very attentive to all of this.
That's great, man. Because you work with him again, right? A couple years later.
Going South.
Going South. That's a kind of a weird, funny movie. Belushi's in that, and
and Danny.
Yeah, Danny Steenburgen. That was Mary Steenburgen's first. That was her big break.
That was her first film.
Yeah,
I do believe. Yeah.
And Nicholson had got her the gig. She was like a waitress. I've talked to her about it. She loves Jack. I mean, she credits Jack with, getting her, her start.
I did a Broadway musical before Going South. And one night I'm doing this thing, and a stage manager comes back and says, Jack Nicholson is in the audience and he'd like to come back to your dressing room. So he came back. Meryl Streep was there in my dressing room, and Lotta Lenya.
Mm.
Ring a bell, Lotta Lenya,
the German actress.
Oh, and the lady that Jack was going with,
Angelica
Houston, all crammed into my little dressing room. And before Nicholson left, he said, "I'm doing something this summer. I'll send a script to you if you're interested." And it was Going South.
Oh, what a sweetheart! What a sweetheart! You know, I love hearing those stories that he was sort of a. Because he always looked like he was having a great time, and nobody loved making movies more than that guy. And it's nice to know he was a good guy, you know.
Great, yeah.
And I it's weird. I was looking at. I'm sort of fascinated with. I got to watch it again because, like, I got it in my head, The Onion Field, as being a terrifying movie, and I know you were in that, but I almost watched it again this morning because I've been sort of curious about. Watching it because I know James Woods in it back before James Woods became this cultural monster. He was just sort of an emotional monster in movie roles, but now he's sort of politically a pariah. But I do remember that being a fairly menacing movie.
Yeah, yeah. An incredible story. I read the book. It's horrifying. You know, it's a real, it happened.
Uh-huh.
And I was the I was a lawyer in jail, and I kind of helped them set it up or whatever. I've got to see it again.
Yeah.
What did you say?
I haven't thought about it in years, and I remember I was really young. I'm obviously younger. I was terrified.
Uh-huh.
That's the same experience I had. You know, I'm 57, so I remember seeing it when I probably shouldn't have seen it.
Okay,
because my parents didn't know what R meant.
Oh,
so they would just take me if they couldn't get a babysitter. I saw Deliverance when I was 11. Did not need that. When did you move out to L.A.?
I think it's 76. Yeah, 76. Cuckoo's Nest came out. I didn't have an agent, and Cuckoo's Nest came out, and I got a letter from an agent. The Gersh agency to say that if I'm ever on the West Coast, like to have lunch or something.
Mm.
I packed up so fast and got into my little car. Boom. I drove from New York to St. Louis one day. And then,
one shot,
yeah.
I did that too. Isn't it weird though when you look back on that, Chris, about the sort of strange moments of panic and desperation? At the beginning where, and now years later, you realize that these guys, they're just like doofus executives that, you know, made us, you know, jump through these fucking hoops. I mean, I'm not bitter and I don't, and obviously I'm not you, but you know, when you look back on, you know, I remember one time I panicked because I had to get from New York to Los Angeles for a Fox meeting, you know, at the studio. And, you know, I drove cause I was moving there and everything was crazy. And then you get there and they don't give a shit. They don't know that you just turned your life upside down to be there.
But if you miss the meeting, you're shit.
I guess so. I guess that's true at the beginning. I guess we never know. You don't want to be that guy. You know, he doesn't give a shit. It's like, no, I'm stuck in St. Louis trying to make a meeting. So you ran out there to Gersh, and you that was your agency? You signed with them?
Yeah. I mean, and I went out. All these people in New York gave me a list of agents to check out. You know, I didn't know. So I went out there, and he was one of the first agents I went up to see. And I remember I got to his office. I didn't know L.A. or nothing, you know. And they took me out to lunch, and another association. And we went to Joe Allen's for lunch, Beverly Hills, you know, Thunderbird convertible.
Yeah,
that was it. You know. And I thought, big God.
They gave you the full treatment.
Yeah, yeah. And then I declined to sign. They asked me to sign. I thought, this is an important thing. I got to go through this list first, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then he gave me a job. I wasn't signed yet. He said, this is a low-budget film in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
What was it?
Oh, it was, what was the name of it? Santa Fe 17, I don't know.
Okay.
Christopher Walken and a French-Canadian actress who's kind of faded out. I don't know what happened to her, but she was, you know, and I got there 5 days ahead of time because I wanted to get, I had to ride a horse. I had to make up with wounds. I was a conquistador coming up from Mexico. And I was here 5 days and took in the scene.
Yeah.
And the morning that I was to be first established on camera, I'd been there 5 days to get everything ready, but I couldn't get anything out of the makeup department. They didn't give a shit. So I go to the makeup trailer to get the wig that I'm going to be wearing.
Yeah.
She got very testy, got the wig and threw it at me. From there, I went, found the producer, director, and I gave my notice. Christopher Walken called me up and said, Chris, what are you doing and all that? And I called Gersh, you know, and the guy I spoke to, he wasn't letting me off the hook. He said, you're going to walk on your first, you know, and they had sent the contracts to me in Santa Fe. So I had the contracts to sign. I hadn't signed them yet. And I said to him, I got the contracts. What do you want me to do? He said, sign them. And that made me really feel good that I could, you know, make my own decisions if there was something I didn't want to do. And they put up with that. You know,
did you do it in the movie?
No, I won.
It's so funny that it was just, it all hinged on a makeup lady.
And then there was the head guy of the horses, he wouldn't let me ride the horse I wanted to do. And I probably ridden much more than he had at that point. But, you know, it was just.
Yeah. Too much. Did you grow up riding horses?
Yeah. You know, we had horses. I went to riding school.
Oh, wow.
All that stuff. I spent summer on a ranch in Wyoming.
I didn't realize that you worked with Jack another time in The Postman, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Postman always rings twice.
Yeah, I have a little piece that occurs either before or during the credits when he's driving down the road and I'm hitchhiking.
Yeah.
Or I'm driving and he's.
Yeah.
I really don't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then we go and he has that breakfast first thing. But that was it. But it was very nice. It was a lot of fun.
Do you like, is he a guy you keep in touch with ever?
I have. In fact, I was with Danny and somebody the other day, and we all asked each other how we talked to Jack, and none of us had. So I don't know. I don't know what's happened to him.
Yeah, it's hard to be with the plague and everything. Now you're used to seeing him. At least you see him at the game, and you're like, okay, he's there. He's at the game. You must be okay. So how did, because it seems like all that stuff about Cuckoo's Nest is like right there. It's like those memories are so fresh because it was such a profound kind of experience. You know, do you feel the same way about Taxi?
Taxi. It's funny because I came out from New York. I told Gersh.
Yeah.
I don't want to do any sitcoms.
Right.
I had a kind of a New York attitude that to do a sitcom is selling your soul.
Yeah, a lot of guys felt that way. Dustin Hoffman felt that way. A lot of actors felt that way.
Yeah, yeah. So he would send me once in a while up to just meet people, even if it, you know, like Starsky and Hutch and some others. I don't remember what. And then Taxi came along.
You didn't do any episodic work? You didn't do any bit parts, you know, little parts in TV?
No, not until, I have since, but not before.
Not before Taxi?
No. Mm. Oh, they sent me up and it worked out.
Well, what sold you on it? Why were you able to adjust your sense of integrity? What sold you on it? Was it James Brooks? Who?
Easy. I just sold out. That's all.
Didn't take anything at all, huh?
Stop doing it. Yeah. No, I got the script, and I just, something seemed to click in my eye. I looked at the part and I saw the, you know, kind of felt I could do this.
Like what, when you read it, what was it like, you know, what was it that got you, that made you realize like this guy's got legs for me, you know?
I mean, I don't remember exact words, but
yeah,
they described it well. And I felt I could do this. And not that I had any background in that area, but I felt I could do it. And I went, I had a neighbor in Laurel Canyon who was cleaning out the bushes, and he found this jacket with a peace sign, Levi jacket. I wore that into the audition, and Levi's, you know.
Yeah.
I got in the frame of mind, and when I finished, as I got out the door, I said, "Wear that Monday." that's what I wore. Until after the second year, somebody stole the jacket from the.
Oh, God damn it.
But they, you know, we.
So it was some old hippie garbage jacket from the canyon.
Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. The Laurel Canyon. This guy found it in the bushes.
Yeah.
Beaten and all.
That's funny. Thank God there was no body there. Yeah. Now, like, it seems like, you know, your character was, you know, extreme and over the top and intense. And, you know, and then you had Andy there, you know, doing his character, which is over the top and intense, but in a different way. Did you guys get along pretty well?
We all got along. I mean, there were times when Andy would do something like be late or whatever. He did something that pissed off Tony Danza.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Danza got a fire extinguisher, opened the door to Andy's dressing room. It was like foam, one of those foam ones. He just went, but that never got bad, because we loved doing the show. We had great writers and we all clicked in our own funny ways.
Yeah, I worked with Judd a bit. He played my father for a few episodes on a show, and I he's a sweet guy, you know?
Yeah. We just, of all the casts that I've been in, Taxi always keeps together. We just did a Zoom the other day with Mary Lou and Carol Kane and Tony and Judd. We're still in each other's lives, and it's great.
Well, that's nice. That's nice. You know, because I always ask people that, you know, because I, you know, as a fan of movies and TV, you know, took after years of doing this and talking to you guys, you know, I always assume, like, it took a long time to break my idea that, like, I always assume that everyone hangs out afterwards, you know, but they don't.
Oh, I was stunned. You know, the Cuckoo's Nest was my first movie. It was a 12-week shoot, and we all became comrades and Nicholson, whatever. I remember the rap, the last part, the last week I saw on the on Cuckoo's Nest was the boat trip.
Yeah.
You know, where we all escaped.
Fishing trip, yeah.
And then we wrapped it, and it was like, boom. Nothing. It was over. And it was like, oh.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
But that's nice that they, well, I mean, the TV is different because, I mean, you know, you're with those people for years.
Yeah.
Like a family, for Christ's sake.
I know, yeah.
And then the, and then Back to the Future, that became a, I mean, you know, I that's, it's like, you know, Taxi was huge and your character was huge, but it seems like the Back to the Future thing just put it all over the top, and that's who you're going to be for the rest of time.
Yes. Yes. I know it's tight me a little bit, but I don't care because I still I get other stuff to work on. And...
Oh, no, no. I mean, I know. But it like, was it like these things when you look back on them? Actually, I don't know. It's weird because you would have thought it's actually the opposite that I think about it. Because, you know, as Reverend Jim, you know, you had this, you know, you were typecasted by as that for a while. But then Back to the Future happened and you just became that guy. And even as Uncle Fester, I mean, you actually, you know, you are always, I see you as you. I don't associate you with with a role. I don't even know why I said that, but I guess I just said it because, you know, it must you must be excited when something has legs enough to keep going, you know, and it must be somewhat nice to re-engage with casts even in a sequel again to do that kind of work.
Well, Back to the Future resonated in a way with people more than anything else I've done. Partially because so many generations of children, young people, have grown up over the years, and who some of who claim that Back to the Future was their life, you know, to look at, and that's a good feeling. And so many people who grew up on the movie. Became engineers and scientists and surgeons.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they all attributed to watching that film. So that's a good feeling, you know.
That's amazing. And you actually, I guess those fans, like, you know, the fans you have for like Star Trek as well, some of the Star Trek work you did, they're very intelligent, sweet, sensitive, nerdy people. So, I mean, because you go to Comic-Con, right?
Yes, I do.
And is that fun for you? Do you make, is it?
It is fun. When I first started it a few years ago, whatever, I was like kind of tentative, you know. But you get these people coming in who are glad to see you and want to see you and want to share their moments with you. And it's you know, sometimes I wake when I first started out, I wake up in the morning and say, oh my God, I'm going to go sign autographs for 8 hours. But then I'd get there and I forget all that because it's just so interactive.
Yeah.
You know? It's great.
So now when do you, have you coming back full circle here? Do you know the play Lear? Have you done Lear before?
No. Oh, yes. I've been in the production years ago, three times, but now I'm doing it. I'm Lear. Before I was playing various parts in it.
Because that's one of those roles where, you know, it's, you know, it's sort of this weird gift that a certain type of actor at a certain age, you know, is either, you know, enabled to do.
Yeah, well, I have some trepidations.
You know? Why, like what?
That I could pull it off. You know, it's huge. Not just in terms of line, but the depth of emotion that's required. You know, that you can't just dance around. You know?
Yeah,
and so it's a big deal, but it's such a great. Part and I don't know, just something got into me that, and I never thought about it. When I was in the three productions years ago, I never thought to myself, boy, I want to play that part someday. I just didn't consider it, you know. And then about 5 years ago, I woke up one day, why not me? You know, it's like it came out, I don't know where that came from, But and I think I'm in a good situation now, up at the Berkshire Shakespeare Company.
And it seems like you just keep working. I mean, like how do you decide what to do? Is it a matter of time or quality, or it seems like you like to keep working and you're just going to keep going.
I'm just going to keep going. I know when I started out, I had doubts that I was going to work at all. You know, then I got into a workshop or whatever. So, and I love doing that. I don't care what the part is, play, who wrote it, whatever. As long as I feel a connection, I just go and do it.
Yeah, and you still you enjoy it.
Oh yeah, totally. I'm doing a film now, George fucking Clooney.
Oh, George fucking Clooney, sure.
Yeah, and Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
I'm so excited. We've already started shooting, and it's a very different character from I'm not repeating anything.
What movie's that?
It's based on a novel, The Tender Bar.
The Tender Bar, huh?
It's a guy who dreamed of being a ball player before he did it. Well, didn't work out. And something that I'm still trying to get it, he gets this old house in Manhasset. His family is grown, his sons, so it's a house full of his family who can't afford to live anywhere else, and he hates it. He hates that they're in the house.
It looks like it's a big ensemble piece.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's great that you're still working. And I thought this new movie, the Nobody film, I know Bob, and I thought it was it's not the kind of movie I usually watch, but I watched it last night, and it's fun. It's what my dad calls a real shoot 'em up.
That's good.
But it was great work, and it's great talking to you, Chris, and continued success, my friend.
All right. Thank you.
Christopher Lloyd, the new movie is Nobody, which was good. Bob Odenkirk plays the heavy in theaters Friday, March 26th. And now let's play some guitar that I'm sure I've played before, but it's always a little different because it's fresh. Serving it up fresh. Same three chords. Fresh. Here it is. Relatively clean. A little vibratoed. A bit reverbed. Stratocaster straight in. Monkey and La Fonda, cat angels everywhere. Sammy Red is here.